boundary. It'll be fun. Okay. I think we are live, my friend. I've been looking forward to this since, like, honestly, since we spoke. Because, one, I thought we almost hit it off instantly. I was like, I think there is sort of, like, a vibe going. But then I started reading about you and started going through Patent Drop and all the interesting stuff that's on there. And I was like, you have a very unique window into the future. Like, you know, people talk about the future the way they talk about the future. People talk about the future in the way they see other people talk, or they read, or they infer, or they, you know, whatever. But
yeah.
I kind of see what you are sort of doing is taking it very organically bottom up, where you're accumulating all the pieces of information that you have, and maybe then you are able to speculate in a widely different way. I don't know if it's better or worse. But is that a fair assumption? Like, you are, all these patents and all this interesting technology that's coming is filtering to me through you. And so I wonder what that makes.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it. I think you know, the patents are interesting, like, nuggets of information.
Mm-hmm.
There's, you know, they give kind of clues as to what these big tech companies are thinking about in the context of, like, building something interesting for the future. And I guess kind of my lens into it is really kind of twofold. A, it's speculating on that speculation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, okay, this is what the big tech companies are thinking, and this is where these patents could also go further. Like, if this idea was kind of was actually developed and released, this is where they could go with that. And that kind of touches upon company strategy, that touches upon industry kind of, you know, trends. And then the second kind of lens is, what are the kind of ethical implications of this for society? And, you know, the reason why I find it quite interesting to talk about those with these patents is, you know, there's a difference between what a company is writing in these patents when they're kind of outlining all of the possibilities with a piece of technology. And that is very different to how the company talks about, you know, the technology or how the product is being released, you know, to the press, the media, and the public. So, you know, from my lens, it's very interesting just to kind of unpack that a little bit without relying on, you know, the company PR machine to be kicking into play. It's very much just kind of seeing, right, yeah, how the company's actually thinking about it.
Just to sort of do a judicious job to sort of giving context to you, to the audience that will be probably, and hopefully not, but probably experiencing you for the first time. Nir does this extremely, extremely interesting, I don't know what to call it, newsletter probably is the right word. Newsletter, is that what you use? Where,
yeah.
Nir talks about the most exciting patents that have been filed for over the last whatever period cycle that he takes. And you can find it at
patentdrop.substack.com.
Or just Google patents, patent drop, and you'll find it, right?
Yeah.
That's a far simpler method of coming across Nir's work, and it's very interesting because, you know, I like to play with it in my way. And so when I knew, I'd been following you on Twitter for long enough to see that you were doing Patent Drop, that you were talking about all of this stuff, and all these interesting and exciting people were coming on board following that. And so I sort of had an idea what it was, but then I started looking into it, and this thought came to me, the fact that you had a very interesting window into the future, because a lot of people predict future with culture and they make some inference on technology, right? So when we talk about how well our phones are going to evolve, right now it's a portable screen that sort of allows me to enter a digital world. Will that get integrated through an optical interface at some point? And then am I always in an AR, VR kind of a world? You know, you'll speculate on culture, but you'll make inferences on technology. And mm-hmm. those are the two things that sort of drive the future forward, right? Like Novel says, science is the engine that pulls humanity into the future. It's kind of like that, right? So it's either culture or it's technology. And mm-hmm. the speculations very often loaded onto culture. I wonder what you think. Is it technology or is it like culture? What is your wildest guess? What's going to be the driving force?
I think these two things come together, right? Like technology emerges out of culture, and culture is kind of influenced by technology, and these two kind of create this feedback loop, whereby, you know, it becomes pretty chaotic to a certain degree, right? Like in terms of just making predictions. And from my perspective, it's a lot more interesting to actually think about the whole kind of possibility space when it comes to the future, as opposed to talking, you know, saying, hey, this one thing is going to be the future, and that's it. I find it's a much more rich conversation and generally a good exercise to just consider the whole spectrum of possibilities and then kind of unpack each of those strands. And what does that mean? Why could that happen? Why could that not happen? And, you know, I kind of have, I have very like weak levels of confidence in, you know, when I kind of think about each of those strands, I apply like low levels of confidence for each of those strands. But it's, you know, I know that one of these things is probably going to emerge as like a winner in terms of general trends. But yeah, I think technology and culture are really infused, especially now. Like, you know, technology is culture to a certain degree.
Yeah, like Twitter's proper culture.
Yeah, yes. So, yeah, we're in a very, very interesting time period right now when it comes to that.
Sure. And it's also interesting, like, to me, where you exist vis-a-vis this, you know, how would you say, melting pot? Like, it's not like you're San Francisco, Silicon Valley tech, all invested in that. Because I have a few friends that are like that and that'll tell me. And then it's not like you were just, you know, NCR, New Delhi, just like a suburban uncle who's like got almost no connection to it except what he reads in the newspaper. You're like very much on the fence, right? You play inside, but you sort of still have this independent identity about you, at least as far as I see. But like my going through a lot of what you've written on Patent Drop, it is very interesting that sort of no matter how we imagine the future going forward, or at least how the front runners, these companies imagine taking the future forward, it just does not exist without taking more data.
Mm-hmm.
Like, isn't that a bottleneck that we are approaching? Are we, do you not think from a cultural standpoint, we're like, I don't want to give you any more data kind of a place?
Yeah, it's, and I think this is where, you know, we are kind of approaching this fork in the road, I think, in terms of, how savvy we are as consumers when it comes to data and privacy.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, you know, the kind of the arguments around centralization versus decentralization, like, you know, security and privacy as a key kind of feature and a value proposition for companies versus those who, you know, the traditional kind of model of like giving something for free and then what you're giving up in exchange is, you know, your kind of most intimate and valuable insights into your life. And I think, you know, we, especially right now, like what's going on, you know, in crypto and all of these kinds of things, like we are approaching big, I think, cultural junctions.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, when it comes to like the big tech companies and you look at their patents, a lot of them, you know, a lot of them are talking about, yeah, capturing more data, understanding people better, basically having a slightly more intrusive perspective into, you know, all aspects of our life, versus, you know, I think the emerging companies that are not the big tech companies right now, that may have not even been born yet, that I think are going to be emerging from a space of privacy first, delivering, you know, value, you know, and there being, you know, transactions, as the key kind of like economic model, as opposed to, you know, let's say the Facebook, you know, use Facebook for free kind of like model. So again, I think, you know, these big tech companies, are, you know, representative. They've come up in an era of, you know, society being generally naive when it comes to, what this means in terms of our data being captured, what it means to have a free product and service. And I think now, you know, we're clueing up. And these companies are, in theory, going to be representative of an old way of doing business. And then it's a question of whether those companies do adapt. And I think you're seeing that, right? When it comes to like, you know, Apple talking about privacy, taking a very forward thinking view, Facebook less so. Whereas, you know, some of these newer companies that are going to emerge, which are going to be, you know, taking a very, very different approach when it comes to making business, making money, and treating kind of users as, you know, people whose privacy deserves to be respected.
So you think there's going to be an entire generation of privacy-first companies that might pop up?
I think it's happening already. You know, I think when it comes to, you know, and I think it's one of those things that's kind of underrated, but, you know, Apple taking the stances that it takes, you know, Telegram, WhatsApp, at least with this end-to-end encryption, you know.
No, dude, I can totally imagine paying $2 a month or $3 a month for a Facebook that just not, like, that I can not worry about my data anymore. So I have the freedom to surf my own phone. I'll give you $3 a month. I don't give a shit, right? Like, can you not imagine? Or like, it sounds extremely possible that the world might be like, you know what? That's fine. That sounds like a very reasonable economic idea to me.
Yeah, and I think there are multiple arguments to this, right? Like, I know there's one end of the argument, which is, you know, look, this is, you know, through doing this, through advertising, through, you know, tracking user data, we have democratized and given people access without any constraint to kind of economic resources to these big platforms, to this bank of like information, knowledge, potential connections. So, you know, I don't disagree with that either. Like, you know, putting a $2, $3, you know, fee on Twitter or Facebook might not be too much for us, but also that's, you know, that's a whole portion of the world who, you know, that.
But they'll adjust it accordingly. Netflix does that right now, right? Like, do with it.
Yeah, but, you know, I think, you know, in principle, like, you know, any sort of cost is a cost, right? Even if it's a cognitive, even if it's a point of friction where you just have to think about entering the platform. So, you know, I kind of see that argument for, you know, it has, you know, valid points, but I do think that, like you said, like, I think there are going to be forks, different ways of approaching business. I think, you know, Twitter is doing some interesting things right now in terms of monetization experiments, you know, where so they're about to apply this super follow feature where essentially, you know, tweets from your favorite creator are behind a paywall, and you pay like $3 a month, whatever, you know, whatever amount the person sets to essentially get their like private, you know, their exclusive tweets. And I think, you know, this is all very interesting because Twitter's advertising model has never really like taken off to the same degree that, you know, that Facebook has.
Right.
But if these experiments work, then, you know, suddenly Twitter is in that world where, okay, like, you know, it's free at point of access for most people, but there are these kind of special features that are paid. And in that world, like, they don't necessarily need to like track user data in the context of advertising. They may be tracking user data in the context of like algorithms and personalization of like content, which in itself is a different conversation and has a lot of like interesting implications. So I think, you know, like you said, I think a lot more companies are going to be doing these kind of like paying users. I think users are a lot more willing to like exchange value for things that they see valuable. And, you know, I mean, even in terms of, you know, what's going on in the NFT space right now with people paying for like digital art and creation. I mean, this is momentous when it comes to, you know, what the economic model has been around creation and consumption on the internet over the last few decades.
Dude, like, I was not surprised even for a second. Like, so I have a friend and I'm very close with that guy. He was into NFTs earlier on, like a few months ago. He'd been in touch with me about his own NFT. He's been trying to do something. And, but the minute he told me about that, I was like, this is Fortnite skin. This is like exactly what kids do when they're buying skins on Fortnite, right? It's like, the first time I saw that happening, I was blown because I thought if I had a skin, I'd play that game better. I got into Fortnite like a year and a half ago because I was stuck in New York doing nothing. There was nothing to go out to. And so my younger cousins and I would play Fortnite every afternoon. And it's insane how much money people spend on that shit. This is just the adult version of that. I'm not surprised by a margin.
I mean, like, this has been something that I've been thinking about and obsessing about a lot over the last year, not strictly just NFTs, but generally the way that I look at it is, you know, we are spending more of our lives online. More of our status is being derived from what we do online, from how we look online, as opposed to in the real world. Now, right now, the way that we show off online is through physical objects that we buy. We translate to these digital images, and then these digital images have, you know, are representations of these physical objects that we have bought. Right. Now, like, that is an inefficiency. Like, you do not necessarily need these physical objects to actually do the showing off for you, right? Like, most of our lives now being spent online. So, you know, the way that we begin to show off, the way we begin to express our identity, our culture, like, a lot of that can take place through digital objects, through digital purchasing, and, you know, whether that's in terms of fashion, digital art, all of these kinds of things. Like, that is just, you know, A, it's cheaper than buying physical objects. B, it's probably more environmentally friendly than buying physical objects. And C, it's just, you don't need these physical objects to do the showing off anymore. And I think, you know, what you needed was just this unlocking of, like, you know, a new kind of, like, type of business model and new platforms for this to emerge, creators to, like, basically enter the ecosystem and know that, okay, I can sell my wares here.
Right.
And I think, you know, it's crazy what you're seeing in digital art, because, I mean, this is the very, very beginning of, like, what I think we're, you know, what I'm pretty confident is going to be something like a new way of, like, interacting with content and creators. But, you know, what we're seeing is, you know, people are showing off, like, people are, you know, buying, you know, pieces of art for, like, $100,000, tweeting about it, saying, like, I'm supporting you. And, like, look, this is how much I support you. And, I say showing off in a good way, like, not in a bad way, but just
the word would be expression. They're expressing.
Yeah, exactly. That's a much better word. So, like, you know, I think this is extremely interesting. Yeah. So yeah, like, the amount of money being thrown, what that means for creators and, you know, consumers. This is like, you know, if there was one thing I can say about the past kind of few years is, you know, last year I was very much kind of out of love with the internet, out of love with screens, out of love with the digital world, feeling burnt out, you know, just feeling like imprisoned by a screen. Today, I feel like we're living in the new Renaissance. I feel like, you know, the internet is now suddenly this magical thing again. And yeah, this is an insane time period to be living through.
Right. I think it was, I was speaking to Varun Maya once, and I'm sure you're aware of who the gentleman is. And he'd mentioned this term to me, and I was discussing Fortnite with him exactly. And he told me, we're moving from a place of where attention and awareness was commoditized to where expression is commoditized. We're moving to an expression economy. And, like, his idea, and I think it makes tremendous sense, that, like, this validates how much our life is now real on the digital landscape, right? Like, we bought Mercedes and, like, Bose and, like, all those status symbols that you'd find at people's places to then express themselves and their status or whatever in the physical confines of their life. Now if I spend 5 hours on Instagram a day, that's more than I spend time in the gym, and I buy clothes for, you know, like, nice clothes for the gym. So might as well find something to express myself with there. And it's extremely unique, because it's not just that, you know, as a creator, I can build, say, a commoditized relationship with people who like to consume my content, but it's also, like, it's opening a door for a new form of art, right? Like, I'm interested in that, because it's hard for me to imagine how we'd stick to our current model of interacting with the digital world with the way it's going. There is endless possibility. It's like discovering Mars inside my computer. I don't need to go to Mars and make it inhabitable. I could probably find a way to get inside my computer, thinking from a purely, like an opportunity standpoint. If we could find a way to sort of spend more time in, say, VR or AR, it became more compatible with our existence. This exact NFT stuff will become the clothes I wear in the digital world.
Oh, 1,000%.
Right? Like, that'll become fashion then. It not just become fashion, it'll probably become poetry in some form too. So there is all this different expression needs that will be fulfilled using money from the physical world in the digital world. And that's an insane transfer of money.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I love where this conversation is going, by the way. But I think when it comes to, you know, I think the interesting thing when it comes to, like, digital expression in this world as well is that, you know, when you think about, okay, the person who was buying the Mercedes, right? It was this kind of mass produced, like, expression of identity. And you kind of form these like very, you know, specific tribes, right? You drive a Mercedes, you drive a Tesla, you know, these are kind of like pretty homogenous, like lumps of people that you can associate with. I think what's very interesting
about... What are you looking for, the stereotypes? go on. I'm interested. Yeah, what are we saying?
I think what's interesting about you know, the internet and kind of digital creation, digital fashion, digital art, is that you begin to have this like explosion of like niches, where, you know, it's the mass production model no longer necessarily works as well in this kind of space. Like you have all of these, you know, people who are spending money on Mercedes are now spending money on like one piece of digital art from one very specific artist. So the ways that people are showing off or expressing their identity are just becoming, you know, they're just exploding in terms of possibilities because, you know, literally like, you know, I made a few NFTs last week that got sold. Now that someone is buying that as a means of like expression for their identity and what they're doing. And suddenly, you know, maybe in the physical world, I couldn't compete in terms of like that identity economy, that expression economy, because I didn't have the resources, I didn't have the contacts, I didn't have the know-how, and I didn't have the kind of want to be creating, you know, a physical item of like identity expression. Whereas in the digital world now, right now, I can do that. I can compete. And I think, you know, everyone in the world is essentially a content creator, right? Like all of us are creating content to a certain degree. All of us are kind of expressing ourselves and our identities in different forms of, you know, media online. And now what you're allowing is through NFTs, like people to actually be kind of buying that. So I think the pool of like possibilities when it comes to purchasing things as a means of identity expression is so much larger in the digital world than it is in the physical world. I think that's going to be very interesting in the context of like, what does it mean to be a big brand in this kind of purely digital world? Is the only kind of advantage distribution and brand recognition? Because you know, when it comes to like physical production, there's no barrier anymore. Like, you know, there's that has no use in the digital world, and the kind of barrier to entry in terms of creating something is so low. Like, that is why you're seeing 18-year-olds, like 15-year-olds, making hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars through creating digital art. Like, they're literally on an equal pedestal to people who have been making art for like 30 years, 40 years.
Sure. Yeah. What kind of art is this? I've never really been privy to the experience of, you know, hanging out with NFTs and whatnot. So like, what kind of art is it? Is it like a wallpaper?
So it's essentially, most of it right now is basically like these video animations, like looping animations, 3D kind of like characters, you know, so it could be literally like, some of it is still, like a lot of it is still images. So like Beeple, one of the artists who really kind of kicked off the latest phase of the hype cycle in December when he sold a bunch of work for, I think, like $10 million or something. You know, a lot of his work is very kind of like dystopic future, but still images, like still graphics. A lot of the people coming up on these platforms are kind of like 3D moving images. So if you want to have a look for yourself, like, go on like Zora.co, which just, you can just get this like feed of interesting, content that people are creating.
It's Zora.co, Zora.co.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And so what I'm seeing right now in front of my eyes, let me see if I can pull a screen and probably show it to everybody who's watching as well. Give me a sec. Probably be able to do that. Yep, it's on the screen. People who can see it, it's like these strange images. One of them says you were dead for some reason. I don't understand. You were so dead. And bad vision. So this is just a blurred image of a guy. Looks like Iron Man, but not as cool. So I see that, but it's sort of strange for me to imagine. I'm just thinking about it now, because what my friend was doing was more tangible. Like, he was, I think, linking NFT to a physical art piece that he was creating, right? But with this kind of stuff, that just sounds like disposable income doing the rounds. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it does not really sound like a economical...
Isn't that all types of, you know...
No, I mean, in the sense, like, there isn't really an exchange of a commodity. There isn't really exchange of consumption. And so, like, I don't see how it could be necessarily embedded into economics. You know what I mean? Like, food, you can't do without food as far as economics is concerned. Or land. Or for that matter, now electricity. Or for that matter, now the internet, right? Like, there's embeds that you cannot do without. This seems very superficial right now in terms of the layer at which it appears in the economy. This seems like this can be stripped off like a band-aid if something was to go wrong.
Oh, for sure.
It's very ephemeral.
I think, you know, a lot of kind of conspicuous consumption is that to a certain degree, right? Mm-hmm. Like the decision to go for a Tesla instead of a Tata, like, you know, whatever their cheapest car was, is disposable income basically doing the rounds, right? And the reason why you're making that purchase is because it's not because you're, you know, wanting to splash money, but you get some sort of like, you know, identity boost, status boost, you know, cultural kind of like lift from that. And I think you're just basically seeing that behavior now being replicated in the digital world. And I think the one thing to stress is that this is still very early. Like, this is extremely early. Like, this is nascent behavior and this is like emergent behavior. And, you know, I think people are figuring it out as they go along. Like, you know, there's a lot of money being thrown towards, you know, these quite established like digital artists. Like Beeple, for instance, was making, you know, one piece of art every day for like 10 years or something online. He was just, and he was doing that for free, right? Like that was just his hobby. And now suddenly that 10 years worth of like brand equity has been converted into like $10+ million of like economic transactions between his fans and Beeple. So like, you know, this is pretty ephemeral to a certain degree. Although, you know, the one thing I would also stress with that is we don't necessarily have the platforms yet whereby these pieces of content that people are buying can live in these kind of in these, you know, like what is the equivalent of the physical digital gallery, or what is the equivalent of the wall in our house in the digital world? And right now we kind of have it, right? Like we have our Instagram, we have like our Twitter profiles, but you know, if we dream like, you know, 10 years, 15 years time, when we're spending a lot more of our time in these VR worlds, like we're living in the metaverse, and suddenly like, you know, we're creating these, you know, both of us have our own like digital homes in the metaverse. And when you enter our digital home, there is like a digital wall. And on that digital wall are the pieces of art that we own. And that piece of art, you know, is one of the things that we bought 10 years ago as an NFT. Like these things eventually, like right now, they may be ephemeral. Right now, they may seem like it. But in the future, that may not be the case at all. It's almost like, I think I tweeted about this the other day, like a lot of these kind of NFTs right now are almost a call option on the importance of, you know, like the customization and personalization of digital environments in the metaverse.
Right. It's like buying insurance on that. It's like I have the ability to, like a call option's a better description.
Yeah. Right. I wouldn't say it's insurance, but it's almost like, you know, okay, let's fast forward. Let's imagine we are in this world. And we, you know, you bought an NFT from me minted in 2021 at the very beginning of like the NFT cycle. Like that is almost like the equivalent of, it's almost like the equivalent of owning vintage wine. You know, right. People gonna be looking at this, they're gonna be walking up to your wall and saying, ah, wow, like that's 2021. That's like vintage stuff. You know, what, you know, in the same way that kind of art, you know, develops, you know, the value of pieces of art, historic pieces of art, like culturally significant pieces of art go up over time. You know, the same thing will happen with a lot of these like NFTs, and you know, there are gonna be some NFTs where, you know, owning an original in a digital world is going to mean a lot in terms of like cultural, you know, cultural like status points, as well as economic points. Like, you know, someone may be looking at that on your digital wall and being like, I want that. But there's, yeah, get that because, you know, there were only 10 digital editions of this.
Right.
you know, if I want that, I need to spend like $1 million on that. So, and I don't think this world is too far-fetched. So, again, like going back to what we were talking about at the beginning, like this is one strand of possibility. But like, if the world does go down that strand, then everything that we're talking about right now with NFTs becomes a very, very integral part of that whole economy. So yeah, like I don't think there is definitely a lot of money flying around. There is definitely a lot of people who have become extremely wealthy in the crypto kind of like bull cycle over the last, like, you know, however many years. And, you know, that money is now flying around, which, to be honest, I don't think is necessarily a bad thing. Like, it's quite interesting in terms of like redistribution and, you know, the fact that that money is flowing down to the arts and creativity. I think that's fascinating. But, you know, putting that to one side, I think there are very distinct possibilities where these NFTs can have extreme amounts of value, like in a world that is not too far-fetched to imagine.
Right. Like, I mean, they could end up being, because my first instinct was to think about these NFTs as, say, for instance, I have a wall right here, right? And this wall's essentially a screen. It's like one of those Black Mirror episodes, right? The one episode they named Black Mirror after Black Mirror, where they live in a room that's all Black Mirrors, right? Say I have that here. And say it plays a piece of art, whatever it is, and it's moving art, right? It's one of the NFTs I bought. And so that's sort of like a painting. It's as good as, maybe like one of these NFTs will be as expensive, as valuable as a Monet, or like as a Mona Lisa, as one of these huge art pieces, like a Michelangelo. Maybe like that's a serious possibility going into the future.
We're not even too far away from that, to be honest. Like, you know, it's, the amounts of value that are being exchanged for some of these pieces of art is, you know, not too far away from that world.
It's very interesting how that happens, right? Like, it, now that, do you ever catch a whiff of this happening? Because like, for most people in the world, stuff like this just arrives at their doorstep. One day they have to make peace that they have with the fact that they have to understand what crypto is, or what this is, or what that is, or what the internet is. Like, I know my parents are extremely reluctant to understand what the internet is, and then they eventually had to make peace. And soon it's going to be a moment where they have to be like, okay, I guess crypto is a thing and I got to know about it. This is most people in the world. Even for somebody like me who likes to stay informed secondhand through, you know, people like you, it's like, huh. So like, a lot of the people, a significant minority of the people I know are interested in this. I should pay attention to this. But then there are some people who are standing over the hill and who watch the future arriving, right? Like, how does that look like? Like, when do you know something like this is about to happen? There's a wave that's coming. There's new stuff that's happening.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think one thing I would say is, you know, sort of context, before, you know, where I'm at right now, before what I was doing right now, which is a lot of things, but like before then I was, you know, focused on one startup. I was working, you know, co-founder of HikerJam, working on just that one thing, very singularly focused, right? Like, it was just one, like, laser focus on this one product, this one community. And you almost kind of put up these blinkers because you don't look at the whole world, or at least I wasn't. I was just very intensely focused on one thing. And I think, like, since stepping away, like, a big motivation for doing that was to really just, like, open up, you know, my eyes again and see, like, what is going on in the world? Like, you know, what's happening? What's about to happen? And thinking. And, you know, on my Twitter bio, it's, like, thinking what's next, which means a lot of things to me, because it's, like, A, it's, like, thinking about what do I do with my life next, as well as, like, actually, like, thinking about what is next. Like,
yeah.
What's next for the world? Like, what's going to happen in terms of culture, in terms of everything? So I think, like, over the last year, I've really just been doing that out loud. Like, I've just been doing a lot of that thinking out loud, and through that process, connecting with a lot of people, like, you know, meeting a lot of people who are actively thinking about those parts of the future. And just speculating a lot myself, just kind of looking at, like, underlying trends and, just dreaming a little bit in terms of where I think, you know, the future can go. And I think once you begin to do that, you know, like, for instance, with kind of NFTs, like, you know, it stuck with me because I did the work before, and not in terms of studying NFTs, but in terms of, like, creating some sort of intellectual framework and speculation around why this could be interesting, right? Like, for me, a lot of things I was thinking about before was, like, digital fashion, and where I think, like, you know, owning clothes, for, like, you know, owning like digital clothes could be really interesting. So as soon as like NFTs came about, it kind of like slotted within this this already existing intellectual framework of, hey, you know, it's going to be interesting for us to show off online. You know, we need, you know, a lot more kind of interesting monetization relationships between creators and consumers. So I think once you begin to like have the building blocks of like what is interesting in the future and why, and what's interesting to you, when you begin to see these like, you know, these new things emerging, you slot it, like it slots into a framework.
Right.
And I think, you know, what you don't do is you don't assess something based on what it is right now, right? Like it's very easy to dismiss what's going on in crypto art as this is a bunch of rich crypto kids like
spending the time of their life making millions of dollars, right?
Yeah. And you know, and that's also not wrong, right? Like that is also true.
Yeah.
But there is something deeper beyond that. And the one thing I would say is like, you know, will the crypto art market like crash? Yeah, probably. Like, will Bitcoin kind of collapse in price? Probably. But you know, when I fast forward like 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, are we living through a major paradigm shift? Yes. Like that's the one thing like I'm pretty damn confident about. I think once you begin to kind of like, once you begin to set up these frameworks, you begin to react less to like news, and you begin to like slot things into some sort of like
well thought out playing field in your head.
Yeah, and then it's like, you know, and I think one other thing as well is that you know, the truth is like none of us really know that much. Like, you know, like we can't make great predictions. You know, all we can do is kind of like my kind of baseline response to anything these days is don't dismiss anything. And think about, you know, and I take this advice from everything that I do now. It's like, imagine a possibility where this thing that is in front of your face works out. What does that look like, and how could that be the case? And that doesn't necessarily mean that you believe that that's going to be the case. Like it could be a 0.5% possibility that this specific future ends up kind of like manifesting. But the one thing you do begin to do is you begin to kind of understand why something might blow up, and just what the world looks like if that does blow up. And I think that is a much richer way of like living.
Full stop, right? Yeah.
Yeah. As opposed to, you know, reacting. Like, you know, the kind of new, going to like the news cycle, right? Like, the way that we kind of like interact with news media, like it's created for like reaction, right? It's just like something, an event happens in the world, it kind of is filtered through the media lens, and then you react to it. And it's like good, bad, angry, sad, you know, whatever it is. And I think like, you know, one of the things I've tried to do actually over the last kind of few years is actually just like not really watch the news as much. Like, not that I'm completely disconnected, but I try not to just like react to things going on in the world, and instead try to kind of set up some sort of like intellectual framework for how I think the world is, or, you know, what the future is, and read things that are kind of contributing to that framework, thinking about things that contribute to that framework. And then whenever something does happen, it's being placed within like, you know, some sort of possibility space. That's a very long winded.
I think what you're trying to do, and I mean, it's, tell me if I do a judicious job at describing it, is that you're retaining your ability to think, because it's true. When you're so busy reacting to all the stuff that's thrown your way, and the reactions either hell yeah or fuck no, after a certain point, you're out of energy to think in any more detail than hell or fuck. Like, those are the most like articulate responses you have to things. And like, part of it is exactly what I tell people about their social media. Dude, turn down the volume on your social media. Like, turn down the kind of stuff that makes you emotionally expressive on social media. I think some of the best stuff to do on Twitter, what I personally like, is follow like these, there's a set of anonymous accounts that tweet extremely interesting ideas. You don't know who they are, so you have no bias whatsoever as to where they're coming from. And they have these extremely interesting intellectual farts that they sort of put out. right? And I'm so interested because I think they're always accurate, but they're good launching pads for me to think further along those lines, right? I initially I was just so much into Naval's Twitter account and his tweet storms, but then eventually that fortune cookie model I outgrew that. I cannot tolerate that anymore as much. But some of the people on Twitter are very interesting, and I think the volume on most people's Twitter accounts, or for that matter, WhatsApp feeds or Facebook feeds or whatever social media they consume, are amped up to a place where they're burning in their head, almost always rejecting something or accepting something with so much excitement, energy, and enthusiasm that is not required, right? This is like, sometimes I feel like it's moved beyond manufacturing consent. Sometimes I feel like it's moved to a place where we together manufacture distraction for each other. And we all just enjoy that circle jerk in our own passivity. Like, it's so much fun. And so we do definitely miss out on some of the more interesting stuff that's happening, for sure. And crypto is one of those things, man. I keep wondering, like, almost nobody I meet who's into crypto does not tell me that there is this, like, everybody who's into crypto is like, there is this deep paradigm shift that's happening, bro. It's like the 60s with LSD, man. What the hell is happening with y'all? What is this change? Tell me about crypto. Like, what do you think about crypto?
Yeah, I think
60s LSD is a good analogy, right?
You know, again, like, I, you know, there's a lot of ways this can all play out.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of ways this can all play out. But I think that the two things, again, like, we're very early in this whole thing, this whole experiment of, like, creating a digital, you know, currency or a digital store of value.
How early would you say?
I mean,
what's a good analog?
Like, I mean, this is even, so when did the Satoshi white paper come out? It was like soon after the financial crisis. Like late 2000s, I think it came out. We're very early, it's even earlier and more nascent than, like, you know, the internet, right? Like, we as humans still haven't really adapted to, like, living on the internet and being on the internet and having our whole lives run off the internet. Like, there's still these kind of, like, conflicting and, you know, like you said about the whole kind of, like, you know, that primitive reaction to something that's taking place in, like, a digital sphere, and that fear or flight, that fight or flight kind of, like, instinct that kicks in just from seeing words appear on the screen. Like, we are very confused and
you know, circus monkeys for someone else's money. That's what we are, right?
So I think when it comes to, you know, the crypto world, like, A, we're very early. B, I think it's going to be, there are just going to be whole sets of use cases that we can't quite imagine yet that will come up. And I think, you know, one of the things is, hey, you know, if you're living in a country that has experienced, you know, extreme, like, hyperinflation, or, like, poor governance, like, Bitcoin is already something that's very useful for these people, right? Like, if you're in, like, Venezuela, or you're in Argentina, and even, like, Nigeria, I think, like, has, like, a lot of, like, Bitcoin holders, you know, a lot of these people are already kind of seeing value in Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies because they can't trust the government, or the financial infrastructure is so weak, or you know, so expensive. So there's already kind of a lot of value kind of being derived. We just don't necessarily see it in our kind of, like, vantage points because we're not on the ground in those kinds of areas that are actually, like, you know, overlooked from a lot of, like, just general kind of geopolitical, like, stuff. I think the second thing is, you know, when, you know, this is kind of like one of the kind of Bitcoin, like, maximalist arguments, which is like, okay, you know, Bitcoin, we know there's fixed limited supply. You know, it's much more efficient as a store of value than gold. If basically, like, all of the value of gold ends up just, like, moving towards Bitcoin, so that Bitcoin becomes this, like, store of value, then Bitcoin becomes worth a lot of money, like, generally in the future. Like, the Bitcoin price, like, skyrockets to something crazy. And that's where you begin to see those predictions of, like, you know, Bitcoin being worth a million, like, one Bitcoin being worth $1 million. And, you know, all of those kind of sounded, like, out of whack, you know, maybe a few years ago, but actually now you know, it's just like, oh, that's not too out of whack.
Still sounds out of whack to me.
I, you know, and it will until it isn't.
Right. No, I mean, like, I don't know, man. It sounds to me a lot like the kind of, like, it sounds so ideologically driven to me. It's good technology. I'm very bullish on crypto in general. I think the prices are going to increase. But the maximalist argument, from what I understand, of crypto becoming, you cannot have a store of value that's so volatile in its pricing. Like, you know, when people start saying store of value and limited supply and all those tiny criteria, I think they're the qualifying criteria for somebody to be, for something to be considered a currency or an efficient currency. That's not sufficient criteria for it to make the standout next model. And like, I agree, there is a lot of evolution that's supposed to happen in the crypto landscape, and there is use cases we don't imagine, and there's some use cases this will fit just like a Lego block. It'll just fit. Like, I think Ethereum and some other technologies, I'm not as well versed, but Ethereum just sounds like that, and even Bitcoin for that matter is going to stick around. But like, it's so hard for me to imagine. Like, it would mean that the entire system of governance we have right now, this semi-stable liberal democracy model that we've sort of instantiated over the last 40, 60, 100 years, now maybe 80 years since the World War, that kind of sort of works and is helping people get off poverty. And you can't have that if the state does not have control of money. So I don't know how it seeks to bypass one that. And then there's other concerns I have, but have you thought about that?
Yeah, I see. I think about that quite a bit. And, you know, I'm someone who, like, I don't come into cryptocurrency from an ideological perspective necessarily. Like, I don't think government is bad.
Right.
You know, I actually think government is great. Like, you know, I think, you know, obviously, like, government is inefficient, but I think generally, you know, there being some sort of like mediator and institution responsible for, you know, the health and welfare of its people, and to, like, you know, make sure hopefully that you know, a society is peaceful and all of those kinds of things. Like, I see a lot of value in that. Now, like, where does that role fit within the kind of digital or, you know, the crypto kind of like space? I have no idea. I don't know. But I think, you know, the one thing that will need to take place, and again, we'll need to see, is a lot more kind of like governments experimenting, economies experimenting with digital currencies, or playing the game, right? Like, getting involved in the game. Like, let's, you know, if this is a worry and we see this is the future, let's start setting up like ways of, you know, being able to, tax people, all of those kinds of things. Like, how do we do that? How do we set up the mechanisms for that to take place? Hmm. And I think, you know, what we're probably going to see is, like, you know, the technology is just, you know, adoption is kind of rapidly increasing, and government is like being very slow. Like, government's generally being very slow. Like, in, you know, India, I think, you know, just recently they've kind of announced the kind of like ban on, you know, cryptocurrency, whatever that means. And I think, you know, there is going to be this space, this kind of like transition phase where, like, government is not on the ball, and this technology is just rapidly kind of like accelerating. I think there are going to be some economies that are very kind of forward thinking. I think, like, China to a certain degree is definitely kind of like of that mold, where, you know, they're thinking about experimenting with digital currencies and all of those kinds of things.
Hold up. Isn't there a difference between digital currencies and cryptocurrencies? Aren't they like fundamentally different?
Yeah. So it's a very fair point. They're right. Fundamentally different. Now, like,
because,
yeah,
I think India is also coming out with its own digital currency.
It's going to be interesting getting into the details of, like, you know, is it on the blockchain or is it not? Like, is it completely decentralized or is it not? You know, if it's not completely decentralized, then it's just the digital currency. And to be honest, we kind of already have digital currencies to a certain degree, in the sense, like, you know, currency is kind of maddened up and most of it is taking place digitally right now.
Yeah, isn't all currency already digital currency if I'm paying through a card or my phone or any of those things? Like, nobody I mean, India carries cash, but aren't we already on digital currency? What is digital currency? How is that an evolution on anything at all?
Yeah, so to a certain degree, like, it's already kind of taking place. And I think probably a lot of these governments are wanting to experiment with, so I haven't gone into the full details of like what these economies are like experimenting with. And I'm on a little bit more shaky ground when it comes to like crypto in the specifics.
Right.
But I think a lot of the things are going to be, you know, how do these, again, like, government is trying to wrestle with like centralization and control, in a world where technology kind of like means that people can be, you know, moving away from that kind of space. So I think, right, again, like some of these governments, you know, experiment with digital currency or experiment with like their own cryptocurrencies with like, you know, pretty much like centralized blockchains, I guess. I think it's the right thing to do in the sense that like they need to try to figure out a path that works for these countries, that works for like the sovereignty of these nations. And you know, that may be the kind of precursor to slotting into this like single financial model of like, you know, this completely decentralized cryptocurrency, or maybe not. Like, again, not sure where the world kind of like moves in that state. But I think there's a lot of like inefficiencies right now with our financial system, especially when it comes to like cross-border like transactions and payments, where Bitcoin just serves an immediate kind of like fix, an immediate kind of like solution, and Ether as well. But just in terms of where that goes next, not too sure. But I think, you know, like you said actually before, like I think Ethereum is really interesting, and what's going on with NFTs is really interesting, because we're beginning to see like this whole new use case, as frivolous as it is, you know, it's, you know, we're seeing these kind of like new applications for some of these cryptocurrencies, and kind of completely new models, right? Like the most exciting thing about, you know, the NFT stuff is the fact that, okay, like the person who bought my NFT, you know, if they resell it, like I am programmatically getting like 10% of every future resale. Like that is something that is like baked in to the code, you know, with the smart contract, like which
that's
is crazy.
That's insane, dude. That's fucking insane. That's tight.
Now I'm interested in making some of my own. I'm like, that sounds like a good economic opportunity, huh?
I think kind of briefly touched on this earlier, but when you think about the relationship now that exists between a creator and a consumer, it turns consumers into investors. It kind of aligns, you know, if you buy my NFT, you are more than incentivized to like, you know, sell, like to like talk about this, to market this NFT, to market me to your like fans, to your followers, to your friends. Because like, if my stock goes up, if everything that I've done goes up in value, like you benefit from that wealth, right? Like, so both of us get richer just from like you buying my NFT, and both of us are also incentivized in terms of helping that asset like grow in value in the future. So, you know, it really is this idea of like turning, you know, your fans, your followers, like your audience into investors in you and your piece of content, which that's all being enabled through, you know, Ethereum and the blockchain and smart contracts. And again, like we are still super, and I keep saying this, but we're in the super early like phases of what this can mean. Like we are, you know, we're still in like, and you know, we haven't even touched upon like DeFi, what's going on with like, you know, these kind of whole, you know, financial institutions that are mimicking what banks do in the real world without any sort of like intermediary, without any like gatekeeper in the middle, like just taking place programmatically. Like there is this whole economy springing up that is like borrowing, lending, you know, delivering higher interest rates than our banks are right now, where there's no like individual at the center of it. There's no like formal organization at the center of it. So, you know, this is a brave new world to a certain degree.
It's funny you say brave new world, my friend, because that's what I've been binging on Netflix these days. Have you heard of the TV series?
I haven't. Is it good?
Oh, man. It's a lot of people that speak in an accent similar to you. So it's a lot of British people. And usually when I see British people in American television, I'm like, this could be kind of good. So it is kind of good. It's very interesting. There's this place called New London where they live. So it's an iteration on London, and America is the savage lands. So, you know, it's true, even literally. And then the whole thing is about this kind of a new society they've built where it's mediated by two things that are weirdly very Indian in its nomenclature, Soma and Indra, right? Yeah. So Indra is the system that watches over everybody and then integrates the social body, and Soma is what manages their emotional levels, right? So they don't feel any other emotion. Now the whole premise is that everybody here is happy and they fit in the social body, quote unquote, no privacy, no family, and no monogamy. Those are the only three rules. And so, like, I'm very fond of shows like these that sort of delve into the future only a little bit to help you imagine what it might look like so you can at least do some sort of an analysis. And it is, to me, that bit is fucking insane. Like, how lifestyle choices become so different. There's an entire scene in which one of these guys from the Savage Lands teaches this guy in New London how to punch. And, like, you'd think it's instinctive that you go, just that, right? But that guy, for him, the instinct's something like this. And even just that shot itself was so interesting to me that if you forget, say, the streak of violence that you've been coded with since you were a kid, from everything from television to classroom competitions in your kindergarten, you become very strange. You become extremely you become an alien like that.
Yeah, it's I've read the book from
Huxley.
But I really need to reread it. But maybe I'll just skip that and actually just watch the series.
So because I haven't read the book. Is it like is this what the book's about?
Yeah, yeah. I don't remember if they have. I didn't think they like had a New London and stuff. So they've probably like adapted parts of it for like the Netflix show. But yeah, like all the Soma stuff or that is that's as it is in the book. I read it a while ago though, so I'm just a bit sketchy on the details, but I enjoy a lot of these dystopic kind of like topics and not necessarily to kind of revel in it in the sense that like we are doomed, but you know, it's an interesting, it's a kind of high fidelity way of like, again, you know, going back to what we've discussed already, like having one like strand, like one possibility thread of the future, just like presented to you in a high fidelity way. Mm. And
Yo, you cut out. What's up, my bro? This happens so often now, huh? Nir, please tell me you're still alive. My gosh. My God, Daya, ye kya ho gaya? Chat. Oh, yeah, you came back. You're here. Right.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead. Okay. Go ahead.
I was saying that, I think like science fiction, dystopic science fiction gets a lot of hate because it's you know, seen to be something that's like very pessimistic. But I think you need that kind of like pessimism in order to like shift towards, you know, better like lands. Like, I think there's always value in like, you know, having that negativity to kind of, you know, see some warning, kind of like have some kind of warning sight ahead, and then hopefully steer away from that. So yeah, I see a lot of value to it.
I think you probably described it best, even for my understanding, which is it's a very high fidelity way to experience one strand of the decision tree as to where things might lead to. And like, you can see it. It's in front of your eyes. Now you can now evaluate it, like, you know, otherwise it's all I have to imagine and then I have to evaluate, and it could be self-serving. And so, I like it for that reason too. And it's very interesting to watch the whole thing go down, like how like it eventually sort of, and I was thinking about it as a matter of fact, when I was reading through all the patents that you mentioned, and like a lot of them are from these giants, Facebook, Google, Apple, Netflix, Disney, right? A lot of them are from like these big giants, and a lot of them seek to enable a newer form of experience, AR, VR, you know, movement, haptics, sound, something or the other of that like interesting nature where the digital world and the real world are slightly closer than ever. And right, but what they rely on is data from my physical environment, which is absolutely sort of a invasion into my privacy. And it made me wonder if like this no privacy policy that I see in Brave New World is not really a rule, but an outcome of what life might have to be to make, you know, all the other edges smooth. I might have to sharpen this one.
Yeah, you know, it's, I think this is where like, crypto is also very interesting, right? In the sense that it's not like full privacy, because obviously, right, you know, all of these transactions can be seen on the blockchain, but there is an aspect of privacy. And I think, you know, this is one kind of side point, but I think one very interesting thing also about one thing I've been seeing on like Twitter is a lot of the people who are buying these pieces of digital art, you know, they're just like pseudo anonymous identities. They're like people with like 100 followers, with like, you know, they've got no real world identity attached to their like profiles, and they're spending like hundreds of thousands of dollars on like piece of digital art. which I think in itself is very interesting for, like, you know, these people are obviously immensely wealthy, but completely private, you know, online more or less. And I think, you know, we're probably going to end up seeing, you know, to a certain degree, technology also, like, enables that a lot more. And I think, again, like, you know, we're not even, we're probably, like, we're still a part of that generation who were, like, we had an aspect of our life on the physical world. We then kind of, like, onboarded ourselves into the digital world at a certain age. And we just, like, we didn't think about it, right? We just, like, did it. It's like, yeah, you know, I'm need. So when I go online, I'm also need.
right. Like, there has to be consistency. It's like two separate rooms for us, right?
Yeah, and here's my photo, and, you know, hey, yeah, sure. Like, I'm just going to tell you everything that I'm thinking and feeling, and I think, like, you know, we're going to get to a point where we're just a lot smarter and savvier about, you know, A, like, what we're doing that's attached to our identity, and B, you know, security and privacy around that. But just generally as well. I mean, I don't know if you saw this tweet I posted last week, which was like, you know, it was kind of this idea of, you know, like the Hindu gods, like, having, like, a lot of, like, avatars, you know, like, there being kind of one, like, core identity, but then a bunch of, like, avatars, like, manifestations of different aspects to their identity. I've been thinking a lot about that for, like, the kind of, like, digital world where, you know, right now, for instance, like, I feel very constrained because, you know, on Twitter, I'm Neer. But there are, like, so many different aspects to my, like, identity that don't necessarily kind of, like, align
get together,
as,
right?
Yeah, they don't get together as one coherent narrative. They don't get together on a coherent brand. But, like, online, when you're on Twitter and stuff, you know, the algorithm has that, you know, the algorithm kind of rewards, like, narrative consistency, right? It rewards, like, consistency when it comes to, like, identity. And I think what's very interesting is actually when we start to move to a world where, like, we begin to peel off, like, layers of our identity into these, like, pseudo anonymous, like, characters, and we can begin to actually, like, you know, I think, like, one of the things about the internet right now is actually, like, to a certain degree, it is, like, identity narrowing. Like, we you know, when we're kind of, like, living our lives by the algorithm, we're always kind of, like, thinking about having to, like, we're rewarded for narrowing our identity as opposed to, like, expanding our identity. And I think even on, you know, I've been speaking to a lot of, like, TikTok kind of influencers for various reasons over the last few weeks. And, you know, one of the things that they talk a lot about is, like, you know, they're almost, like, imprisoned by the TikTok algorithm. Like, they've got their niche and they have to stick to that niche. Otherwise they get punished by the algorithm. And, you know, that isn't aligned with, like, explosion of identities, right? Like, so, you know, kind of one of the predictions, not necessarily predictions, but even, like, one of the things I think is going to be very important for us is, like, how do we begin to peel off the layers of our identity where, you know, I can be, you know, there's A, and I have a character, I have a visual, like, manifestation of that, like, there's one aspect of my identity that may have no link to, like, need. And maybe there's another person. Maybe we have, like, 10 of these, like, identities that are just exploring different assets of our, like, personality. Because I think we need to, like, A, I think it leads to, like, a fruitful, like, you know, happy life where, you know, we're expanding ourselves as opposed to narrowing ourselves. And I think, like, a lot of our life as we grow up, you know, and get kind of, like, socialized and institutionalized to a certain degree is narrowing, right? Like,
right.
You know, schooling narrows, college narrows, jobs mostly narrow, you know, online, you're kind of like, sure, you have more access to all of this information, but you're still kind of ending up being, like, narrowed and focused around, like, one very specific thing, as opposed to, like, expansion of yourselves. I've forgotten where we started this conversation from.
I think it took a very interesting turn because halfway through it, I was like, No, it's true. I see it for myself, right? And I don't see a lot of creators talking about it. But what people recognize you for, if you do not break the mold, you're going to end up becoming a consequence of people's wants. And it's just never, like, every time somebody tells me this is what the people want, I'm like, that is a death sentence you're signing for yourself right there. Because, like, really. And not just that, it may not be death, say, in terms of output, but in terms of creativity, that might lead you down a road you don't want to go down. And it's true, man, this algorithmic dictation of our life, I felt it. The way I adapted to it was, I was like, I'm going to narrow my personality to a few aspects that are going to be on the digital world. I do not want the whole thing on there. Not anymore, right? The rest of it I keep private for my people and my folks. So, and this is what I suggest to everybody. Like, unknowingly, you're all creating content. There is no two ways about it. Your Instagrams and your Twitter is content. There's no two ways about it. Sit down for a minute and write out, because it's true, we already have many avatars. There's a core personality that Prakhar understands about himself, and there's one Prakhar that goes out to meet Neer, and there's one Prakhar that goes out to meet, say, somebody else. It's always that way. So sit down and feel yourself and understand what are the different parts of you. Write it out, right? And then ask yourself, what are the parts that go online and what are the parts that do not? Now, for somebody like you who's so invested in technology in the digital world, that might sound like a more primitive approach, but I think that helps me remain like sane in my head, where everything is not dictated by the other's gaze. Because, bro, here's the thing, right? Like, I know people who'd put their wedding on a vlog. Mm-hmm. And it's like, bro, if my wedding's going to be on a vlog, it's not going to be my wedding. It's going to be all my subscribers' wedding. Like, it is quite like that. They're all watching. I have to consider what I can and cannot do. I'd rather retain the freedom to fuck up my own wedding. Not that I want to, but like, I want to take it to crazy directions like myself. I don't want, right? And so that's a step too extreme for me. And so I ask people to narrow down on the personality characteristics they're fine with being online, and then explore them online. And then whatever you save, don't let that be eroded. Explore that in your private time, away from public gaze, away from everybody else's opinion. With you and your friends or your family or your circle or whoever you think is appropriate. But dude, this stuff that you do, because that's how we initially got in touch too, right? Like, you have these random phone calls with random people and talk about random stuff. Like, what's this? How's this? Like, you do, man. Like, I think something about you'd said, if somebody wants to talk, I don't even remember what context this was, because this was about a year ago, a little less than a year ago maybe. But you would asked on your Twitter if somebody was interested in having a conversation about you, something, something. And then I saw on your patent drop stuff that you were like, if you're missing workplace banter, hit me up. As if like there's somebody on the other line, like a helpline. Hey, are you missing work-life banter, right? So what is this stuff like? Is this a research method that you use for yourself? Like, just figuring stuff out by going to the source firsthand? Or like, what is this?
Some of this is professional and some of this is personal. So like, the workplace banter stuff was professional in the sense that, I'm advising a company that is working on, a product in that space. So for me, it's like, okay, cool. Like, let me just use, I've got these distribution channels, like, let me put it out and then have a conversation with whoever, reaches back. And then a lot of the other things are also personal where, like last year, for instance, when I stepped back from my startup, I was still in Mumbai. And, just during lockdown, and I didn't really know what I was doing next in my life. Like, I really hadn't thought out like that whole plan. To be honest, I think I saw you tweet about wanting to like wake up in Japan. When I stepped back, I this was before the lockdown, I'd made that decision. The thing that I really wanted to do was just go to Japan for like, 3 months or whatever, and just like be inspired.
Chal, let's get tickets.
So some of these things are personal. So at that time, like, I put out a tweet being like, hey, here's my Calendly link. If anyone wants to talk to me about anything, like, I'm here for an hour. Like, we can talk about product, we can talk about community, we can talk about personal life, anything. I ended up speaking to like 60 people over the course of those like 2 weeks I ran that experiment for. So my whole day was just talking to one person after the next. It was actually very interesting for me because, I'm generally quite introverted. Like, I don't like, I don't generally like those kinds of like interactions. Like, there's a side of me which kind of like shies away from it. And now in terms of like advisory stuff is as a result basically of those conversations and doing things online. So yeah, just generally, some of it's personal, some of it's professional. When it comes to personal stuff, like, I really am just trying to optimize for like serendipity, I guess, in terms of just like, why not? Like, let's just have a conversation. And I think it's really cool to also know like the people who you meet on Twitter, just actually like get to know them a little bit better.
Sure.
It's always interesting. And I always feel like I feel a lot more connected to people that I've actually had like an hour long conversation with.
Sure.
Like if they do anything, like, I'll just support it. Like, cause I want them to like win. Whereas, you know, and likewise as well, right? Like, you know, the reverse is also true. And I think it's very difficult to do that until you've kind of had those like longer conversations with each other and just like been in each other's space for a while. Like, you know, yeah, now that we've had this conversation, like, you know,
are we bros yet?
Yeah. You know, like, you know, whatever I can do to like help you win and whatever you need to win at, like I'm there, you know? Right. And for me, like that's been one thing that I've been getting a lot of energy out of. It's just like, you know, as things have been, you know, like I'm not really at any end of the spectrum in terms of like being, you know, a huge success or whatever, but like, you know, there's stuff where I'm at right now where like, you know, I just couldn't imagine being at that spot like 10 years ago, 15 years ago. So like when I can help someone, like I am helping them, like,
right.
Like, and the one thing I've tried to do is I've tried to minimize like, you know, the thought it takes to like, if I can help someone very easily, I'm going to do that because I want people to win and I get energy from that. And I try to minimize like the thought it takes to like, you know, like if, yeah, I try to minimize the friction of like how I can help someone to doing something. And I think generally, actually, like, even when it comes to not helping someone, like I try to minimize the friction between thinking something and doing something generally. That's how like Patent Drop came out. That's how a lot of these kind of like things come out. When I'm like tweeting, like everything I'm tweeting is very like, I use Twitter like people use WhatsApp. Like okay. I have a thought and it's like, let me put it out. And usually like something might just come out of it. And like Twitter is a serendipity engine as well, right? Like, you know, all, if you think about Twitter, you're like 140 characters or however many characters it is now, like 200 characters away. Like the formulation of 200 characters, like one certain combination of those characters could like dramatically change your life.
Yeah. It's weird like that. It's very weird like that. Because like you could be saying the same thing. But if you said it in that right sweet spot, like that shit's going to get viral.
Yeah.
Right?
And it's, you know, I've had a few moments over the last year where like just something that I've done has gone like very viral. And there's two things. Like one thing is it's gone viral as an offshoot of just me being me, which I think is the best thing. Like it's not trying to be viral. It's just like, this is me. This is what I'm thinking about. Here it is. And every time that's happened, it's been transformative in terms of like people I've connected to, professional opportunities that have come out of it. And just the, you know, just generally like how I think about the world. So like, yeah, it's the internet is a crazy, crazy place. And I think going back to what you mentioned earlier as well, like it's very, you know, when it comes to like the algorithm and all of these kinds of things, there is this like inherent pressure to, and I've experienced this as well. Like, you know, who should you be online? You know, should you be yourself? Should you be a version of yourself? And the one thing I've tried to do is like really, and this is not, I guess, great advice, but one thing I've tried to do is like, I've really tried to just like just be the same. Like,
I do that too. That is how I prefer it. That's like, that's the only way I can trust you on the internet is if I feel like, you know, it's like a projection, right? It's like a screen with a projection. So if I punch through that screen, would I actually hit Nir or would I hit something else that needs projecting? If I would hit Nir, that's the only time I can trust you. Like I have twisted rules, but they work. And what I mean by that is that you follow through. It's the same person in and out. It's not. And like, honestly, bro, since I've been in this content creation business, I understand the pressures to be somebody else. I also understand why people unknowingly get into this trap where they become somebody else. It has an active role in how you get shaped, particularly if you're as early into the game as most creators are, which is, well, 15, 16, 17, 18, right? Or even up until 24, which is when I got there. Like, it's such a formative time for you, how the world interprets what you say. Because for me, here's the deal, right? When I'm saying something on the internet, it's not even like, probably Nir can sit outside and be like, oh, Prakhar speaks of that niche. For Prakhar speaking everything he has.
Right? That's the core of Prakhar. Right? So for me, I'm speaking. And so the feedback I get is directly on to me. And that feedback and then a performance after that feedback eventually starts shaping your personality in a very weird way. And but here's the funny part, right? Here's what I think is so interesting about what you do with those phone calls that you do. I don't know how often you do those anymore. But I've found with myself and with all the interesting people I've had the privilege of knowing that that flavor comes from some novel kind of extremely gritty research that they didn't think of as research in the first place. Right, that they thought of as something that they like doing or it was an experiment they had to go through. But it's like a very door-to-door kind of a thing where you have to knock, get rejected, sometimes get accepted. But the acceptance not very beautiful either. It's like this very gray, like muddy area that you're sort of going through and you don't understand why. And then you come out on the other side with this bunch of insight that you never knew accumulated. And it makes for like extremely novel information because it's accumulated in a very whimsical way. In a very personalized way. It's stacked in a very novel way in your head. And so like that makes me think, that and patent drop, because both of those research methods to me from the outside are like extremely gritty door-to-door kind of things, right? Like the interesting part about patent drop is not just that you report on what patents came. Well, I'm sure you go through a selection process of filtering out which ones to put out, but also that you discuss the implications that you then deduce what it might do in the future. That there is all this thinking that is happening on top of pure information that is opinion and analysis that you do, right? And it's extremely gritty to me in the sense of like going through that process over and over. Sometimes I've spoken about AR. What else can I add about AR in this article, right? And my feeling is, like I was reading, I think about it's Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, right? They were the guys who worked together, right? And I think they would do this weird thing where they'd sit with, what is that thing called? Actuarial reports. And they'd go through the whole thing, man, just page by page. And it was insane because it's exactly that kind of research. And it brings out the most interesting results for me. So to me, that's a very interesting twist to you. I'm very curious as to how those shape how you think in the future and how you act in the future.
You know, one of the things... it's interesting what you just said. Like, I agree with everything you said. And I've been thinking a lot about this recently. And one of the things I compare it to a lot more now is almost like jazz and like improvisation. And I try to like improvise and have a lot of play in like what I do and how I live my life at the moment, where when I'm writing like patent drop, I'm literally like writing as I'm thinking. Like I'm looking at it, I've like digested it, and now it's almost like I'm playing the piano. It's kind of like, and often, you know, like, it's not written very well. Like I'm not a great writer. Like I'm an okay writer. But like, I'm just trying to, like the way that I'm just like thinking and writing and it is almost like playing the piano. It's and just like improvising. And like when I'm tweeting, it's the same thing. When I'm like doing work, and you know, for me, like I think one of the things that you know, when I think about like what is like my core like strength and what is the one thing like I'm really really good at, and for me it's like marrying the kind of right brain with the left brain. Like that's where I think, like, you know, if there's one thing that I'm like uniquely good at, is like marrying like logic with creative leaps. And I think like I think just like setting yourself up for like improvisation and play generally, like in all areas of your life, is probably just going to result in a lot more kind of like interesting things. And it's just much lower, like it's low pressure, and it's more, I don't know, like how do you get into a flow state with everything that you do? How do you like really, when you're thinking about a problem, how do you like live in the problem? Like how do you immerse yourself in it? Like how do you get the connection, you know, how does your like mind connect with the problem to like be in a space? And you know, that's kind of what I try to do with like patent drop. That's what I like literally do on Twitter. Like, you know, and it's that's what I try to do in like my professional life. And you know, it has its disadvantages as well. Like, there's a lot of disadvantages to that approach. Like, it's not a great approach. Like, it's an approach. But for me, that's kind of and again, like, you know, if we were to kind of zoom out of this conversation, it's generally like one of the things I've been thinking a lot about is, you know, like what's the best thing to do in terms of like your professional life? Like what's the best way to live a life that like results in, you know, successes or achievements and all those kinds of things. And the one thing that I've kind of definitely kind of like taken away is thinking about like, what is that one thing that I'm like uniquely good at, and just like going all in on that, and like almost like forgetting about like knowing, okay, my weaknesses are A, B, and C, and I'm happy with being weak at A, B, and C because I'm super strong at like Z. And I'm going all in on Z because that's the one thing that I'm probably like uniquely good at, like I'm better at than like 99% of the world. And I will make up for A, B, and C in other ways.
Do you know what that Z is for you?
I think it's that kind of the creative leaps with logic. Like I can very, very seamlessly shift between, you know, going deep into data, doing deep research, doing deep like work in terms of logic, numbers, whatever it is, and then kind of marry that with like a creative leap of faith. Like, what are all of the creative possibilities from that? How can I think like
insane,
non-intuitive about just, you know, something like a possible solution? And I think that's like the one thing I'm very, and you know, it's funny I can say this with conviction because like last year I couldn't say this with conviction, but like that's the one thing I'm very, very good at.
Maybe the space has helped, you know, it's like oxygenated the thought.
Yeah, for sure. I think just generally, but you know, also like, I think go through kind of like waves of like feeling good and feeling bad in terms of like confidence. And right now I'm feeling very, very good. Mm-hmm. But you know.
So we should have gotten you at a worse time.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah,
that could
very much change. So,
right. No, dude, it's like, it's one of those things that nobody ever tells you. Like, really, I think this should be, it's one sentence deep and it changes so much for so many people. We have such a hard time adjusting to those days when we're just not feeling it. There's days, there's weeks. And usually there is a compass that's guiding us through that. Like when I feel sad or upset or I'm having low confidence days, and I have those all the time, it's like, okay, let me look into myself and see what it might be. And sometimes it's just a false alarm, but sometimes it's just the beginning of something new. Like I'm bored with something I'm doing because I relate to what you said 100%. Like when I talk, I do exactly what you do when you write. I'm chasing the thought as it goes. So for me, it's dancing. For me, it's like, it's just like figuring it out on the go. It's not very different from, it's all improvised. I have no notes. Trust me, both these screens here are not notes, right? And I like it that way. It just makes it more real to me that way. And it has its own pluses and minuses, but I prefer it that way. And I prefer the flow state, right? When I'm talking and I'm on long rants, particularly on my other channel, it's all flow state stuff. I couldn't be doing it if I was thinking about it while I was doing it. That's not how it's going to happen. And so I think there is something extremely unique about accepting that some days are going to be shit. And yeah, they might be telling you something.
1,000%. And I think, yeah, like this is one thing I've tried to do a lot more of when I'm speaking to people. Like I'm always very, very honest about like the good and the bad. And the days where you feel, you know, because on Twitter, like, you know, things can always look great, right? Like things can always look like this amazing achievement and everyone's, and then, you know, I even get anxiety from this, like, you know, going on the Twitter feed and seeing, you know, people do have achieved A, B, C, and you're like, damn, like what, you know, what have I done? But then, I mean, I once wrote this, this guest column for the Economic Times when I was talking about Instagram, and I call like Instagram almost like a Ponzi scheme. It's like a psychological Ponzi scheme.
Yeah.
And I think this can be applied to like most of social media in the sense that like, everyone kind of trades, like everyone trades like getting the attention and recognition of others. But they trade that for their self-esteem because there's always someone else who's like
better, bigger, stronger, you know, first, more unique, original, like whatever.
All of those things. And everyone is like incentivized to like present the best of themselves. So then when you're seeing the best of everyone else, you're like, damn. And when you're, you know, when you're not feeling the best of yourself, it's, you know, you just feel like an utter failure.
It's a bad comparison, dude. You're comparing your backstage with their fore stage.
Exactly. And, you know, I think that's one thing I'm also like very conscious of is, you know, like, if there's one thing I would want to do different is actually just be a lot more like open about like that side of things on Twitter. Just like the days where you just feel like shit. Yeah, nothing's really working.
Yeah, yeah. Those are the, like, the way I've come to see them, at least in, say, most of the good times and sometimes even the bad times, is that's just recalibration. That's just like a spark for something new. That's just around the time you make a big decision. Like, I recently quit my most popular content venture, and that content venture was trending through like podcasting charts and whatnot. I did that with a couple of friends, and I'd felt that feeling before. Like, I felt what you were saying, like, this, nothing's working out, something's wrong, even though everything seemed right. And, you know, you were at that space where you're normalized to that kind of, that amount of right. And then suddenly I was like, huh. And so I quit it. And instantly the next day, there was this new renewed sense of hunger, more confidence, more feeling in control. Like, it's weird how that works. But it was a moment for me to introspect and begin experimenting again. And I think maybe it's the curse that people like you and I share, where we are so... Because I can tell you're a creative guy and you're extremely intelligent, and that combination, you're extremely interested in ideas, and you have this unique ability to sort of export ideas from the abstract into the real. Like you said, you make those leaps of creative faith, and you know, and so I think this is sort of like our personal curse, where we've got to keep ourselves hungry long enough, or we've got to keep ourselves introspected deep enough to be aware, you know.
I like that a lot. I think, like, you know, they're usually, our bodies are, there's some physiological reaction to, like, something just not sitting right.
Right.
You know, there's something about it. And I think, you know, maybe you feel this too. Like, I'm very impatient in the sense that, like, it's very difficult for me to just, like, just sit with that and live with that. Like, sure. That's not a life worth leading to me. So, like, usually it means that you have to, like, this, you just need to make a decision, or you need to, like, you need to cut something or do something, or, you know, you need to recalibrate and reimagine things. I relate to that a lot. I think it is, you know, it is our body telling us something that, something isn't right now, and it's well within your power to, like, change that.
Precisely. And so, you know, the good and the bad almost sort of come together, because when things are going good, keep one eye on the ground and keep flying straight. Things are going bad, keep one eye in the sky and keep walking forward. And it's like that. Yeah, man. And I mean, as creative individuals who are sort of our own Sindbad the sailor, you know, sailing into the oceans, trying to figure stuff out. And it's all uncertain and unclear. And, you know, I relate to that feeling, but I'm glad there's somebody as smart, capable, competent, and ready to fight as you on the battlefield. And I'm glad to have you on my side, given now that we're bros. And I mean that. This has been awesome, man. I've had a great time talking to you today. How are you feeling?
Yeah, dude, it's been very fun. I've enjoyed this. I just like good conversations, and this is a great one.
I think your AirPods sort of lost battery sometime like 10 minutes ago or so.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know. I think so. I think the audio output started just like it changed a little bit ago. But can you still hear yourself? Can you still hear the conversation in here?
I can hear you fine.
Okay. Okay. So I may be wrong. But this has been absolutely fun, man. I'm so glad we could do this.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun.
Hey, anytime you have something interesting to talk about, let me know, and we'll put this on again.
Yeah.
All right. Solid, dude. I'm going to end the stream now.
Awesome.
So the stream ended. This was good.